Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 2:40 p.m. and that is Central Time. And today is April 9th. And today being Friday, it's a big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I thought we'd kick off today with this rather interesting graphic of the credit impulse from China. Because the one thing that's quite clear is that we had a massive move in terms of the percentage of just percentage points of nominal GDP, the jump that we had from below 0 to 20% in 2008 through to 2010. So that's a great example of just how willing China was to boost its economy during the financial crisis. They pumped more money into their economy than anywhere else, and that led to a lot of different lessons being learned by China. The first, of course, was that there was a clear need for additional stimulus, because back then the Chinese economy was heavily dependent on exports. The size of the domestic demand story was considerably smaller than it is today, and that reliance on the global economy was something that really was ramped, or I think rammed down their throats during the global financial crisis. They were completely surprised by just how susceptible the economy was to the drop-off in demand, because demand from the USA practically evaporated. Then, because of the collapse in commodity prices in 2011 and 12, well, then demand from the commodity producers started to evaporate. Then you had the sovereign wealth crisis in Europe, so European demand evaporated. So we had the big push in terms of sending credit out into the economy in 2008, 9, and into 2010, and then again in 2011 through 13. At that point, then, we started to see rounds of quantitative easing being produced in the USA, and the US economy and the foreclosure crisis had really ended by the time we got to about 2012 and 13, and the worst of the European crisis was starting to ebb as well. And then, of course, we had the big pop in the stock market in 2015 and 16, because there was this enthusiasm about the Stock Connect finally going active, and there was a lot of money chasing around. Then, of course, there was the massive move in the shadow banking sector that had started with the big credit push in 2008 and 9. And between about 2016 and 19, they slowly but surely squeezed the shadow banking sector out. They've started to allow defaults. Then there has been a lot more regulation. Now, of course, from a Western perspective, that regulation is viewed as dictatorial and overbearing. But the reality is that the Chinese administration views it as essential in order to ensure social cohesion. Now we're looking at the credit impulse having popped again on the upside, although I think it is particularly relevant to highlight that it was already going up heading into 2020, and the credit response from China relative to other pops on the upside over the course of the last 15 years was considerably less in 2020 than it was, for example, following the or during the credit crisis in 2008. China didn't need to have that same credit impulse because they were more effective in locking down the economy. And the, again, dictatorial way that the economy was marshaled during the pandemic also ensured that factories were able to stay open because whole populations of workers were quarantined within their respective domiciles within the factory structures. So they had active factories during the worst of the lockdown, which is not something that many other countries were able to achieve, while at the same time holding down the number of infections overall. And now we're starting to see the credit impulse coming back again. So on this occasion, we've had a very different environment because it was really China bailed out the entire global economy in 2009 and 10. And that has not been the case on this occasion. Instead, it has been the USA. The USA is the country that has massively increased its credit impulse. And there has been combined monetary and fiscal accommodation. So, obviously, now we can think about what happened after that massive move and stimulus in China after the global financial crisis. Well, there was a massive surge in property prices. There was a massive surge in demand for credit products, which really birthed the shadow banking sector. And then it required remedial action. So that resulted in the shadow banking sector getting curtailed, and then measures to try and stamp out speculation in the housing market, and then additionally various other regulatory impositions to try and curtail speculation in the wider economy as well. And that continues. So we can look at what's been happening recently, where the Ant Financial IPO was shelved. Whatever the initial rationale was for that, whether it was political or regulatory oriented, doesn't really matter. The fact is that what we're definitely seeing is clear efforts underway to try and curtail the influence of the largest companies and to ensure that these companies do not become too large to fail. Of course, an additional way of thinking about it is that they don't become so powerful as to represent a threat to the governing administration. But as we look at what we can anticipate from China as this credit impulse rolls over, well, if it does trend back down over the next few years, then it's likely to be in response to rising wages. There's a big question circulating right now because commodity prices are certainly trending higher. And I've got Amazon up there, and I do intend to talk about Amazon during this broadcast. If we look at the CRB commodity index, unfortunately, the CCI, which is the equal weighted commodity index, or the continuous commodity index, is no longer available as on my feed. And the CRB is heavily weighted by energy, but it certainly trended lower from 2008, and it is now on the cusp of breaking that downtrend. There is a big question right now whether this strength in the commodity sector is as a result of the significant damage done to the global supply chain during the pandemic, and therefore transitory in nature, or whether we are now at a point where we're at the dawn of a new secular bull market, and that the pivotal point and turn was when the West Texas Intermediate oil price went negative last year and trading down to a negative $40 level is a profound change. What we can definitely think about is that they have tried to excise it from the price history, but everyone who pays attention to the market knows that we went into negative territory back in March of last year. And since then, we've had a significant rebound. But I don't think that anyone could say, looking at this price, even though we've had this significant rebound, that oil prices are back in the region of their all-time peaks. The simple fact of the matter is that we've had a big rebound in oil prices, and a large part of that has been because of an artificial supply or a lack of supply, because OPEC has ensured that, or at least cooperated to ensure that there is less supply in the market. US onshore production is lower by about 2 million barrels a day. So there is certainly less supply in the market right now. And we are looking at recovering economies. So there's certainly potential for more demand. If we are going to get the kind of infrastructure development that economies all over the world are planning, whether that is going to be for renewable energy, whether it's going to be for the promise of green hydrogen, which the CEO of Fortescue Metals has been talking up, whether it is going to be for new roads, new dams, other pieces of infrastructure, particularly transmission lines, if we're going to be looking at more distributed forms of energy production. And then, of course, there is the critical need for additional housing, where there is an acute lack of housing in a large number of countries, which is sending prices higher. That's all going to represent demand for infrastructure, and that is also then going to create demand for oil, for coal, for industrial resources, and cement. So all of that is certainly likely at least over the next few years. But of course, then the supply side of the argument is where we have the big question about whether these trends are secular in nature or short term. Because China has massive supply, or the ability to supply cement, whereas they don't have copper. The USA and OPEC have plenty of additional supply of oil, so that curtails the ability to, or I guess the rationale for why there should be a secular bull market and why prices should trend higher and overcome the peaks put in 2008. Whereas when we look at copper, we're already there. Copper prices are right in the region of the peaks put in during the commodity bull market. This is representative of a much more acute, I think, supply deficit overall. It's not because there are countries that are conspiring to ensure there is less supply of copper. It's rather the opposite. They are trying their best to produce as much as they can, and it just isn't there. We need a whole new investment cycle in developing copper resources. And this is one of the catch-22s that is being introduced by the environmental sector. So, one thing that we can definitely think about, though, just going back to what we can see with China, they are certainly not going to try and bail out the world on this occasion. They don't believe it's in their interests to do so, because they weren't thanked for doing it during the global financial crisis. And on top of that, they are not coming out of the pandemic crisis as the weakest country. So they don't feel like they need to do that. And at the same time, their supply of very young workers is not nearly, let's just be very simple about it. We're now in 2021. All the same workers that were working in China in 2008 are 13 years older. So the median age in China continues to rise. The supply of cheap young labor continues to contract. The population is increasingly well educated, which means there are fewer people that would even consider taking really hard menial labor when they don't have to. And the services sector continues to increase, so that's putting upward pressure on wages. So, regardless of whether we are looking at medium-term or secular bull market arguments in the commodities sector, it's largely beside the point when we look at the upward demand on wages. Certainly, when we think about the PPI figures that came out today, they've surprised on the upside, and I think that's normal. It's certainly something that shouldn't be particularly surprising because year-over-year figures are going to be loopy. It's quite likely that they are all going to surprise on the upside, for the simple fact of the matter is that we've had this incredible monetary and fiscal support. And that would suggest that we're going to have these surprises on the upside for at least the next quarter, if not 2 quarters. And then we'll start to see, I think, more realistic comparisons on a year-over-year basis. But I can certainly think about what happened with Mrs. Tracy's business. She was going to place an order about a month ago, and the factory in China said that it wasn't worth their while to complete the order on the price that she had negotiated a couple of years ago. So they're, on the one hand, taking advantage of the fact that she wasn't able to go there and price out alternative suppliers, so they have less competition. But it's also reflective of the fact that they have to pay their workers more. They have to pay more for the components as well. So that's all factoring into the increase in prices. So they were asking for a 20% increase in the base price of the manufacturing, and that's happening across the board. Any of the people that I know that have businesses that are importing from China, they are all reporting increasing input costs. So there is the clear potential that we are going to see inflationary pressures imported from China, because importers are already working on quite narrow margins, and then, of course, we can think about the fact that companies like Tinuiti, which are looking today at they were just bought out, I think, by a private equity firm. They are now, and companies like them, these marketing companies, they are increasingly taking a lump out of the revenues from online retailers. Because if you want to have an online location, instead of paying for rent at a physical location, what you instead end up doing is paying for marketing. And they generally add approximately a quarter to the retail price of any item. And that means then that anyone who wants to survive online has to pay for marketing. It means they have to increase their price. Of course, higher priced items also tend to appeal to the Amazon algorithm, and they get promoted because it increases the take that Amazon gets on an item as well. So these additional factors, on top of the increase in the input price, will contribute to higher prices for goods overall. And that's without talking about rising commodity prices. So commodity price inflation is an additional layer on top of those pressures. It's one of the primary reasons why the China's credit impulse is beginning to roll over. So China will try and keep their inflationary pressures under control, and they'll have limited success in doing that. On the other hand, it is the USA with its massive deficit spending, which has been the savior of the global economy on this occasion. So when we look at global deficits overall, just on an aggregate basis, we get an idea of what we're looking at, and it's currently around $1.3 trillion. Not entirely sure why this is not charting, but we can definitely see the figure that's created. So it was almost 2 trillion, or just over 2 trillion, back in March of 2020. It's still hovering around the 1.3 trillion level. This is a combined figure for global economies. So this deficit spending has taken a leg higher as a result of this crisis, in just the same way that it took a leg higher during the global financial crisis. It's very unlikely that it's going to come back below $1 trillion. So we're going to see progressive and increasing deficit spending, particularly in the USA, because the US has been by far the most active in supporting its own economy and also trying to avert the populist revolt, We've definitely seen that militant arms of both the left and right-wing parties have emerged over the course of the last decade, and that has been equally true in Europe as it has in the USA. It's a direct response to the way that the global financial crisis was tackled by governments, which sacrificed the interests of voters in deference to the interests of corporations. Now there is an increasing argument going on about the rights of workers and the exorbitant privileges that corporations and their owners have enjoyed. We're also seeing that this entire argument about the rights of workers has been, in many respects, co-opted by the environmental sector, which of course raises the point that we are looking at a point where there is a clear correlation between left-wing ideals and the rise of and power of the climate change movement. The one thing that is coming out of the pandemic is quite clear that the urgency with which people are animating or really becoming active in promoting the ideals of combating climate change and combating inequality and combating the power of corporations. This is all conspiring to increase the power of the worker amid calls for significant increases in corporation taxes. And that's something that we've seen this week with Janet Yellen talking about the need for a global minimum corporate tax. Now, that's something that Europe has been animating for quite some time, and they haven't been especially effective, and not least because countries like Ireland and Luxembourg will use veto powers to try and curtail any real change in their corporate tax laws. And that's one of the primary reasons that the vast majority of the NASDAQ 100 companies have their European bases in Ireland so that they can avail of those lower corporate taxes. We can then think about what's going on in Amazon. Well, Amazon defeated the efforts to create a union in one of its warehouses in Alabama today. That warehouse alone employs 5,000 people. The company employs nearly 1.3 million people. Walmart employs about 2.2 million people. So between those two companies alone, they employ 1% of the entire population. Of course, the share is now rebounding, and this has been really quite a positive week for extremely large cap companies overall, because bond prices have been starting to rebound. Now, we did have some weakness in bond prices today, and the price is coming up off the lows in the last few hours of trading. So why would it be that bond prices are starting to rally now when they've been falling for most of the last 7 months? And it seems to be simple enough. The Federal Reserve said this week, and with the release of the minutes from their most recent meeting, that they are in no hurry to raise interest rates. So we can think about, well, what is it that will then contribute to them raising interest rates? The bond market has been selling off really rather aggressively. The one thing that I would really like to highlight is that we've had a number of failed downside breaks. There has been a loss of momentum in terms of the bond price. It really accelerated lower at the end of February. Since then, the decline has moderated, even though it's continued. There's still a sequence of lower rally highs. It's right now in the region of this 132 area. So if it can sustain a move above 132, well, we can think about where the stops are. Stops will generally follow the sequence of lower rally highs lower. It would suggest that there are a lot of stops that are just above the 132 area. If the Federal Reserve is not going to raise rates, And the bond market has been overly active in selling off. Well, there must be a reason for why they were selling off. And I think it's pretty simple. There were more sellers than buyers. And that's quite clear because in the first quarter of the year, the US Treasury issued about $1 trillion more bonds than the Federal Reserve was willing to buy. That threw the onus of responsibility for supporting the market onto the private sector, and they demanded a higher yield to do so. And in order to get that higher yield, prices had to come back down. And they could always delay their purchases until there is evidence of some support. This rising yield overall, and the fact that the US government has been now pushing out this stimulus, has resulted in $1 trillion being taken out of the Fed and pushed out into the economy, and that pushed against the leverage ratios for the banking sector. So banks then created demand for money market instruments. Money market instruments went back into negative yields and would have gone substantially more negative were it not for the Federal Reserve acting this week to, or I think it was, sorry, the end of last week, to ensure that banks could achieve a higher yield. And that represented a $100 billion infusion of capital, and it was that effect that contributed to prices starting to rally again in the bond market. Because it's quite clear that during quantitative easing overall, prices have tended to decline and yields rally because investors take the money that's being produced by the Federal Reserve and go off and buy other instruments, and that has been the most clear rationale for why asset prices have rallied during periods of quantitative easing. If the Federal Reserve is now moving to support bond markets overall, and we are not going to have the clear supply dominance in the bond market, well, then there's the potential here that these higher yields represent value from the perspective of an international investor. So there is scope for bond prices to rally. The one thing that nobody is really willing to talk about in governments is what to do about this large number of renters and leasers who have not been paying their rent over the course of the last year. There has been a moratorium on evictions, and that moratorium was extended again until the end of June. Now, we certainly know that the US schedule for making vaccines available to every adult has been accelerated so that within 2 weeks, anyone who wants a vaccine will have the ability to go and get one. Well, then we're only in April, so then that would suggest that we're going to have the economy opening back up again in May. And by the time we get to the end of June, the rationale for continuing to extend the moratorium on evictions, well, we're going to get into a much more pronounced period of moral hazard because it encourages malingerers not to pay rents at all, regardless of whether they can afford them or not. And when this moratorium ends, there is going to be a difficult environment. Obviously, there are some landlords will be willing to work with their tenants, and they'll work out payment plans. But that's going to be on a completely ad hoc basis. And in between that benign outcome, well, we have to consider that there will also be a less benign outcome where landlords will enforce their rights and kick out tenants. And that will be particularly difficult for the poorer section of society, and particularly those people that did not benefit from the pandemic. And against that background, there is just no way that the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates. So we're still in this incredibly benign environment. And that is the primary reason why we continue to see that high yield spreads are trending lower. And at 235 basis points, we are nowhere near danger signs. So there is the clear potential that we are going to see low interest rates persist for quite some time, at least until the challenge of this eviction moratorium is well understood and resolved, and then until the Federal Reserve has got clear evidence that the inflationary bias has returned to the economy, because they're not under any illusion that there are still significant challenges. So it really suggests that the credit impulse in the USA is going to remain a significant factor. And that's beneficial for the banking sector overall. So banks continue to trend higher, and this doesn't look like much more than a consolidation in the region of the peaks. When we then think about the regional banking sector, it's also consolidating in the region of its peak. Now, we have certainly got short-term overbought conditions, but if we're not going to see the interest rates rising, and we're going to see ample demand for credit, and banks will then be able to create credit by extending it into the economy. That's very different from the aftermath of the global financial crisis. So we certainly have the potential that inflationary measures are going to become more persistent, for the simple reason that one of the big missing ingredients from inflation after the financial crisis was the inability of banks to engage in risky and credit growth activity. And that credit multiplier ensured that inflation did not take off. Whereas on this occasion, the credit multiplier is certainly active. And it's likely to continue to be active. And not least because the central bank has said that they will backstop loans. They told banks during the PPP loans last year that they would be completely preserved from risk. And I don't think anyone is under the illusion that banks won't be bailed out in future, because everybody knows that the banking sector is a requirement. But what is likely is that control of their lending is going to be increasingly focused on political fiat, and the priorities of politics is likely to be a very significant factor on where and what kind of projects do in fact get approved. That's also relevant in terms of the union movement and the rights of workers, but the confluence of this interest and political will is certainly behind the continued demand for renewables. So we've had a significant drawdown in terms of these growth companies, particularly that for the renewable sector. Everything from the solar sector to wind to hydrogen have all endured these processes of mean reversion over the course of the last few months. Now we're also seeing that the IPO sector is at least steadying in the region of the trend mean. So this is an additional factor that any time we start to see more money pushed into the system, then that is beneficial for growth. That's the primary reason why the Nasdaq has rebounded in such emphatic fashion over the course of this week and last. So this is still a consistent uptrend. It has now found support in the region of the trend mean, and we still have ranges one above another. So it's a steep uptrend, but it is still in action because we continue to have this supply of cheap money. And as long as that remains the case, then we're likely to see continued asset price inflation. We've also started to see that with bond yields beginning to ease, Gold prices have steadied up. Now, they were in slightly weaker territory in here today, and that was in line with the weakness we saw in the bond price. So it's quite likely that this correlation between gold and bonds is likely to remain a factor for at least the near term. And a good part of the reason for that is because of the outlook for growth and the need for a safe haven. There's a lot of argument about the inflation hedge, about whether gold is an accurate inflation hedge or whether Bitcoin has become the inflation hedge of choice. I just don't believe that Bitcoin is really being regarded as an inflation hedge. Instead, it is a lightning rod for speculative interest. And the very clear fact is that Bitcoin is a speculative asset, and it has a high correlation with other speculative assets. So that is the antithesis of an inflation hedge. But what we are definitely seeing in this environment is that because we have countries all over the world engaging in quantitative easing and money printing, and we can just think about the fact that during the financial crisis, the migration to quantitative easing was the preserve of countries that had something approaching a reserve currency. Since then, we saw that Australia has now engaged in quantitative easing, and then we've seen a number of emerging markets engage in quantitative easing, and India was the most recent of those this week, and that took a chunk out of the rupee in at one point during this week. Bitcoin is steadying after a day of selling back on Wednesday. Everything seems to happen faster in the cryptocurrency markets, so this is still looking like a loss of momentum and a loss of uptrend consistency. So it's got a lot of work to do in order to confirm that we're still in a demand-dominated environment. The minimum requirement is a sustained move above 60,000. If we start to see it coming back below the 50,000 level, well, then that will have completely broken the uptrend, and it would greatly enhance the potential that we are going to see a more pronounced process of mean reversion. I think one of the most important points is that Bitcoin does tend to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average rather than the 200-day moving average. So if we then just look at this on a weekly basis, we can see clear examples of that. And the 1,000-day moving average is now up to about 11,000. One way, and perhaps the most bullish way of thinking about Bitcoin, is that it will eventually revert back to the 1,000-day moving average. But by the time it does that, the 1,000-day moving average might be in the region of 20,000. That would probably be the most bullish way of thinking about the price, and that would imply that we'll have a significant overextension, and that it will then revert in a very abrupt manner. In the meantime, I think the most likely scenario is that we are going to see a more choppy environment overall, and this is particularly important from the perspective of stock market investors, because Bitcoin is a risk asset and it's a lightning rod for speculation. So if it does break on the upside, then that is likely to be very bullish for risk assets of all hues. When it eventually does roll over, then that is likely to be at least a coincidence and potentially a lead indicator for trouble in the wider market, and it would contribute to a much greater and more volatile move on Bitcoin than every other asset, but other assets could also engage in mean reversion activity. So the other point, of course, is that we've just had mean reversion on a very large number of risk assets. When we think back to January, it was all gold, And then we've had this really quite pronounced pullback in everything from solar and wind and hydrogen and the IPOs and the SPACs and the largest companies in the world. And they are all bouncing from the region of their respective trend means. And it's in direct response to this very benign environment we have in terms of monetary and fiscal stimulus. But of course, that is also likely to take a toll on the dollar, and the Bloomberg Dollar Index is now also right in the region of the trend mean. And of course, this is the other side of the equation. If we're going to see bounces in risk assets, something else has to balance up that ledger. And the dollar is where the selling pressure is likely to be most acute. With the clear intention of the US government to spend its way out of trouble, and the only way that they are going to ever pay back their debts is to devalue the currency. Well, they are certainly unabashedly trying to do that. We're also seeing that this clear intention of the USA to flog the dollar is sending out money into the rest of the world as well. Capital is both global and mobile, so it is moving around the world and looking for attractive assets. And the Euro Stoxx Index, the Europe Stoxx 600, has now broken out to a new all-time high. So we are looking at the conclusion of a 21-year range. And that's a really quite profound change. Europe is now completing an extraordinarily lengthy period of consolidation, and it's being fueled by this increasing supply of money. The ECB is also, it's not printing money at the, it's I think probably the easiest way to think about it, it's printing more money than China and less money than the USA, so we're somewhere in between as the second largest central bank. And the Euro Stoxx Index is now coming up to the upper side of its own 21-year range. Indices like Germany are already leading on the upside, and this is, of course, also a play on global reflation because a lot of Europe's exporters are very dependent on global demand overall. Then, when we look at the emerging market index over the long term, it is right in the region of its peak from back in 2007. Now, China represents about 30%, if not more than that, for this index. And of course, we have the relative weakness that we're seeing in companies like Tencent and Alibaba. Tencent has the additional headwind in the short term of one of its largest holders liquidating part of its position. So that is likely to weigh on it for at least the next while. The last time that happened was back in 2018, and it represented a 50% drawdown in the price. So we can't rule that potential out on this occasion because it's a similar amount of money getting taken out of long-term holders and flooding the market with a supply dominance. But then, of course, we can think about the fact that the Chinese government is weighing on its biggest companies. So Baidu has had this extreme advance and pullback, and then it bounced right from the region of the trend mean. Ideally, it's going to have to hold the trend mean. I do think that China's markets represent a significant risk for two particular reasons. The first is the credit impulse. With the lack of stimulative action at home, then they are robbed of the kind of incentive from investors that other assets have. But then there is this regulatory risk from the government as well. So that's an additional challenge. And it's not something that is easily quantifiable, but it's when we just think about the challenges that China's largest companies have relative to big companies elsewhere, they're just more profound. They're something that everyone has to pay attention to as they think about where to invest overall. Well, that of course also burnishes the outlook for other emerging markets, particularly those that are friendly or viewed as friendly destinations by the rest of the world. So India is certainly one of those, and it continues to trend higher, although it has got or it is consolidating right now. And then the Vietnamese index has also broken on the upside, and this is also, I think, a really quite important move because it's breaking out to new all-time highs. And this is, of course, for a country that has a land border with China and is playing the same kind of ambiguous relationship with China versus the rest of the world that lots of regional Asian countries are doing. And of course, one of the most and the quietest of them all is South Korea. And the KOSPI index continues to steady now, following this really quite profound advance, where the index doubled from its lows in 2000, or 2020, I should say, and most particularly has broken out of this very lengthy period of consolidation. The Taiwanese market is also continuing to extend this bull market overall. Of course, it's being led higher by the semiconductor sector. And then, of course, we also had the news in here this week that Mario Draghi quashed the attempts of China to take over one of Italy's semiconductor companies. So China is going all over the world attempting to acquire semiconductor infrastructure, know-how, and technology. And it's being rebuffed just about everywhere. Everyone understands that one of China's key weaknesses is that they don't have a domestic semiconductor industry. They are pouring money into it, but we're talking about one of the most capital-intensive industries in the world. And it just does not happen overnight. Taiwan is sticking out as an attractive alternative. So that obviously is fuel for speculative interest right now because there's an acute short-term shortage of semiconductors. And that is all the more profound as the global economy increases and grows. So there will be a supply response. It's only a question of when there will be a supply response. But it's not an easy sector to increase that supply response, but it will occur. At the same time, the shortage of semiconductors and the inability of China to source what it needs in terms of technology, it means that there will be increasing demands. And that will occur by hook or by crook. Samsung and Samsung's CEO said quite clearly about 18 months ago that if China needed help, that they would provide it because they don't really see that there's much alternative. So anyone who thinks that China won't eventually develop its own semiconductors isn't looking at realpolitik because when a major country decides that they'll spend whatever it takes to achieve a goal, then that goal will be achieved. China is also building massive numbers of wind farms and solar panels, because they want to become energy independent. They've signed a deal with Iran, and what that also probably means is that there will be Chinese aircraft carriers in the Straits of Hormuz in the not so distant future. They are going to absolutely ensure the security of their supply chains. So we're looking at a changing global economic environment. China has decided that they don't need to bail out the rest of the world, and they would much rather to be feared than loved. Whereas the USA is now changing heart. They are intent on bailing out the rest of the world, and they would rather be loved than feared. And that's why we're seeing a renewed commitment to this socialism and also to the rights of workers and to climate change and to taxing corporations, whether it's because of their polluting sins or because of the rights of workers. The reality is that it doesn't matter where we look, governments are broke. And they are going to look at corporations as cash cows. So that suggests that we are going to see higher corporate taxes. We're going to see more taxation in terms of carbon. And what is increasingly evident is that there's an urgency to these arguments. And there's a clear response coming from the resources sector. They understand the political imperative. So certainly we can think about the measures that are being taken by companies like Fortescue, where they are polluters but are looking to get ahead of this regulatory headwind, or is potentially a regulatory tsunami from the carbon fanatics. And then you have Rio Tinto, which has tried to position itself, and I think effectively positioned itself, as being the provider of renewable energy metals. So that's an additional, I think, consideration. I will post this graphic in comment of the day today, but we can think about the metals that are needed in this demand for clean tech. Copper is required for 8 of the 10 potential uses. Nickel is also required for almost the same number. Then we can look at lithium is also one of the primary renewable energy or clean energy metals. The argument for uranium is not as profound, but it's obviously also something that's going to represent a lot of demand, and so is platinum. And as we go down this list, those are perhaps the most important of the renewable energy metals. So if we're looking at where are the secular bull market potential items, then this renewed demand for commodities is certainly standing out as a potential outcome. And then, of course, if you have this clear political will to build, then it's likely to continue to be beneficial for renewable energy. And it's likely to continue to be beneficial for technology and growth. Because if interest rates are held artificially low, and it looks increasingly likely that we are approaching that kind of environment where bond yields are unlikely to surge past the 2% level because of the damage that that would do to government finances. It's all well and good to say that the market is, or that bond prices are market oriented, and to tolerate a rise in yields in the short term. That makes central banks look tough, and it makes them look more credible. But the reality is that the cost of servicing debt and the ongoing funding requirements of governments against a background where they are spending for fear that they will be ousted by restive populations, it pretty much means that central bank independence is becoming a rare commodity, and they will have little choice but to fund the spending prerogatives of politicians. So this is eerily similar to what we saw in the early 1970s, and it pretty much sets up the reality that we are moving back into an inflationary cycle. One of the clearest correlations is that we had lower bond yields, we had stronger corporations, we had more globalization, more deregulation, in the decade down from the high in yields in the late 1970s. In the 1970s, we had less globalization, more protectionism, more taxation, and more power of unions, less influence of corporations, and more financial controls. That all contributed to inefficiencies and higher prices overall. So the sector that generally does best in that kind of environment are more defensive in nature. So consumer staples have continued to extend the breakout, and this continues to look like a reasonably consistent trend overall, and particularly in the latter half of 2020 and onwards. This also represents a secular bull market. The dividend aristocrats are the kinds of companies that have come through any number of different cycles, both inflationary and deflationary, and they remain well placed to continue to prosper as we look increasingly towards an inflationary outcome overall. I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.